100% black owned and operated.
They said it couldn't be done.
We did it anyway.
The hottest independent network in the world.
Kaboom!
You want prizes? We've got free prizes. You want cash? We've got lots of cash. Simply download Bashani Radio app. Allow push notifications and listen for your chance to win loads of cash. Please don't tell our CEO it's his money we're giving away. We won't tell if you won't tell. Bashani Radio app. Download it for free in the App Store.
You're listening to The Spectrum with Bob Ivory and Ivory Coast Media Production.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Spectrum with Bob Ivory. Have an ultra super special guest with us today in the person of Judge Leonya Lloyd. Let me give you some information about her. Leonya Lloyd is a public speaker and author whose career as a judge, lawyer, and teacher has spanned decades serving the citizens of Detroit. Having sat on the 36th District Court for more than 20 years, Judge Lloyd has lived a life with many stories to tell, which are captured in her new memoir, Your Honor, A Journey Through Grief and Restorative Justice. Her award-winning justice programs for drug and prostitution offenders have been featured on the National Geographic Channel, A&E Network, and in the Detroit Free Press. She is a product of Detroit Public Schools and received her bachelor's and juris doctorate degrees from Wayne State University. Before becoming a judge, she was a partner in the law firm Lloyd and Lloyd, which she shared with her late sister, Leona. They were featured in Ebony, Jet, People Magazine, along with the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News. Both she and her sister would go on to be elected to serve on the 36th District Court and be the country's first twin judges to sit on the same district court bench at the same time. They were affectionately dubbed Twins for Justice. In her spare time, Judge Lloyd enjoys going to concerts, upscale restaurants, and traveling. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Leonya Lloyd. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure and a delight. And also, just salute your work in helping offenders and those that worked in prostitution find better lives. I think that's absolutely outstanding.
Yes. And I enjoyed doing that. I definitely enjoyed doing that.
All right, let's talk about your memoir. Let's talk about your book a little bit. Why is it so important? Why was it so important for you to write this particular book?
Well, I wanted to get across to my readers the message that they can never give up on their dreams. Mm. Too many times, I saw people in my courtrooms who had given up a long time ago, and that was just not acceptable to me. Okay, that wasn't acceptable. Mm. And my job was to reignite in them a flame so that they could go after something that they wanted to achieve.
Sure.
And, you know, I've had them for 2 years, so by the time those 2 years were over and we saw people accomplishing something they thought they had never, ever would do, they gave up, and it showed them that they gave up too soon.
Mm.
And so my whole thing was Leona and I had talked about this, and she was one of the reasons I did this book, because we both wanted people to understand that you have to dream, and even if you dream that impossible dream, understand you can make it possible. You just can't quit.
Mm.
You just can't quit. And it that's the main thing. You cannot quit. I don't care what happens. I don't care the fact that, you know, things crumble around you, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pick up the pieces. You can have failures, learn from them, keep moving, and keep going. This is why it was important for me to write this book. This was a message we always wanted to push, because we had been through so many things in our life that would normally would put people back.
Sure,
it would have been easy for us, you know, to stop. And, you know, particularly when my mother got sick and how, you know, she made it difficult for us to study in college.
Right.
And to say, well, forget this, let me go get a job, and I move, and I just make some money and get an apartment.
Okay.
And forget the dream about going to school. Forget that.
Hmm.
I got to get away from here because my mother's not acting right.
Wow.
That was not possible to me and Leona. Leona and I said, this was our dream. My mother had brainwashed us since we were little to go to college.
Wow.
And because she had those problems with the nervous breakdown, with the subarachnoid hemorrhages and all of that, we had been brainwashed thoroughly by her.
Wow.
So I looked at her one day and I said, I don't care what you do to us. She turned the lights off so we couldn't study.
Right.
I said, I don't care what you do. I said, but we are going to stay in school. I said, you have made that something for us to believe in, and it's too late for you to take it back now.
Wow.
We said, you did a real good job at brainwashing. I said, and we're not quitting. I looked at my mother and said, we're not quitting. She could turn the lights off. She could do whatever she wanted to do. But it was, you know, we just had to then regroup and you replan.
Wow.
And our thing was, we're going to have to move on to campus because next mama's going to take the car. And then we won't be able to drive to school. How are we going to get there? How are we going to lug all these books on a bus? And so then we went and we started interviewing for jobs on campus. We got that. We then went into the dorm and got the applications. And January the next year, we made the move.
Wow.
It's like you have the dream.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to make sure it happens. You've got to make sure you take the steps. And you're going to hit potholes and you're going to hit all these negative things. Deal with it and keep moving. Keep it moving. And that's the main purpose of this book and what we both wanted to get across. And we both planned to write it together, but of course she passed.
Sure. Well, that had to be some pretty extraordinary circumstances early on in your life. So, I mean, that's a lesson in itself. I mean, how were you at that particular time when you were dealing with the issues with your mother?
We were in high school. Everything to us was going along pretty good.
Okay.
We were chosen to be the high school commencement speakers, and we were the first black ones at Mumford to do this. My mother had been a valedictorian, so she had spoken for her class in high school as well as her nursing school.
Okay.
So she was helping us with the speeches, and she was being the mother that we knew, the mother that loved us and you know, nurtured us, et cetera.
Right.
But a few weeks before we were to actually, you know, get up there at our commencement, graduation, my mother had a nervous breakdown.
Wow.
And totally became someone we didn't know. And we were there at the hospital, the psych ward with my father, and we're like, you know, 16.
We turned
17 in August that year, but we were 16. And we knew she wasn't acting right. She was seeing Jesus on the TV screen, and Jesus wasn't there.
Wow.
And when you don't know what that is, and you're a teenager, and my mother, we would sit and watch TV with her all the time. We did stuff with my mother all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she said, you see Jesus there? I said, huh? And she said, right there. I said, well, Mama, what are you looking at? I said, and I named who was on the screen. And I laughed because me and my sister said, Larry, Jesus ain't on the screen. And so she said, yes, he is. I said, no, he's not. I said, then I stopped laughing.
Wow.
And I looked at my mother because she looked serious, and I said, Mama, do you still see him on the screen? And she looked at me and my sister, and then she knew that's the wrong answer to give. So she said, no. And so that was the beginning of us realizing when she would sit at night, and for those of us who are old enough to remember that TV did go off at night, and it didn't. It didn't play all day and all night.
I remember that.
Right. And so you know,
Star Spangled Banner comes on, right?
Right. She was sitting up watching a blank screen.
Hmm. Wow.
And so we would come in there and say, well, Mama, what you looking at? Ain't I not?
Hmm.
And then she would get up and she'd go and get in the bed. Well, all of these were signs that, you know, the delusions and things like this were going on, but we didn't know. And then when she really started acting out, and you know, getting, you know, really mean and nasty and hitting at my father and running out the door, no
right.
clothes on and stuff like that, he said, I've taken your mother to the hospital. He said, meet me down there. And when we got there, and we're looking, and we go, well, why are we here? Why are we in this unit?
Hmm.
And, you know, we didn't know. We didn't understand. And when the doctor, you know, was explaining to us, she said a nervous breakdown. And he said, well, what causes that? And he said, depression.
Hmm.
I said, depression about what? And she said, because my mother was cheerful all the time. And he said, only she knows.
Wow.
And that's something that, you know, we're going to have to put her in some counseling to see. Well, counseling back then was not like it is today.
Right.
And so her counseling consisted of, you know, Miss Lloyd, what are you depressed about? And
mm-hmm.
she said nothing. And then that was it. You keep taking your meds. And she, back then, they had a method where they would hook you up and basically shocked you.
Electroshock therapy?
Yep.
Wow.
And she couldn't take that. She couldn't take it because she had a subarachnoid hemorrhage before.
Mm.
And the subarachnoid hemorrhage, we were five. And we remember the ambulance coming, you know, to get her because they had got us out of school. And all she told us was to mind our father and to do what he said. She just didn't feel well. And they took her away in the truck. And so, you know, she was there for several months, but she told my father, she said, don't let them go in my head. She said, because if they do, I won't come back the same.
Hmm.
And you have to promise me. And so she remembered this, and at least she remembers telling it to us when, you know, when she came out, she was much, much better. But she said, my father, but he was inundated with questions, and we need to do this. We need to bore a hole in her head. We need to get the fluid out. We need to. My father said no. And he said, but you don't understand. She could die. He said, no. She told me no. She told me not to let you go in her head. And they said, well, if she does live, she'll probably be blind, and she would be. They had a whole list of negatives for my father.
Right.
And he said, I understand. He said no. He wouldn't pray in the chapel.
Hmm.
And the thing is that she didn't die. Every day he came in there, when the doctors came, they saw she hadn't died, but she was blind. She couldn't see.
Hmm.
And this is when she first opened her eyes. It took a while before she even opened her eyes back up. And then when she could see my father, she just said, you know, who are you? And he said, I'm your husband. She said, I'm married.
Hmm.
And he said, yes, and you have two little twin girls. They're 5 years old. And she said, I have kids. My mother didn't remember anything.
Wow.
And the sad thing I write about in the book is that when you have that, it's considered like a bleeding stroke.
Mm.
And if you know anybody who's had a stroke, it takes away a lot of the memory.
Wow.
It takes away a lot of your skills. People who have strokes normally can't continue doing the jobs that they have done. And they're either going to be fired, or, you know, or they quit. They can't do the job.
Right.
They go through counseling today to reinvent their lives, to readjust and see what you can do. Or they get on assistance, because they can't do the job they did before.
Right.
Well, my mother couldn't either. She couldn't either, but there was not anybody telling her anything or counseling her. My father didn't understand why she wouldn't go back to work after 10 years. He didn't understand. She still was a nurse. She still kept her reciprocity up.
Mm-hmm.
And she just kept saying no. She told her girlfriends who were nurses, they said, come on, Naomi, you can do this. You can do this. Just follow us and just, you know, follow us. It'll all come back to you. The fact that they said it'll all come back to you. They knew as nurses, Mama had lost some of that brain power that she had. and because they were nurses. They just didn't know the degree. And I used to hear, you know, when my parents were the other grown-ups, and I'd hear someone ask my father, are you going to stay or are you going to leave? And my father said, I'm not going anywhere. He said, this is my wife, the better, the worse.
Wow.
And he said, I have two little girls. And he said, I'm not going anywhere. Well, fast forward, when my mother had the nervous breakdown, which is connected to the depression that you get from a stroke.
Okay.
A lot of people get depression right away, within the first couple months. My mother hid hers. She just went along, tried to figure out who she was again.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question, because I wanted to ask you a question. That had to be a traumatic experience for you to see your mother go through that, and your young girls, and even as teenagers. And you mentioned the character of your father. Is that how you were able to kind of withstand or to move beyond kind of, you know, the trauma of those experiences you had with your mother?
Yeah, it was, we clung to him when that happened, because our father was a symbol of strength to us.
Okay.
You know, when any time there was something wrong, you know, I can't describe how safe we felt with my father. One night, you know, we had commandeered at the basement of our house. I guess you'd call it like a little teenage cave. We had a little TV down there, a little black and white TV. And,
okay.
And that was me and Leona's space. And my mother and father laughed at us. And they don't want to be in their bedrooms. They want to be down here in the basement. It's damp and everything else. But that's the kids. So we had a poodle. And the poodle kept barking. It was dark outside, barking at the window. And we couldn't see through the window, up, you know, basement windows. And so we said, why are you? Be quiet, you know. And the dog kept on and kept on. And the owner grabbed him, held him, talked to the dog. Dog kept looking at the window, And I walked up to the window. I can't see out. It's dark. And I said, you know, I can't see out. I don't hear nothing. And then the dog calmed down. A little bit, my father came down 5 minutes after the dog had calmed down, something like that, 5-10 minutes. And he said, did you hear anything at the window? And we said, no. And he said, there was a man looking through the window. That's why the dog wouldn't be quiet. That's why he wouldn't be quiet. See? And he said he was looking at the two of you. And he must have thought the two of you were the only ones in the house. He said, and I watched this man. My father was behind these bushes that were like a natural border from the patio, from the yard to the patio.
Mm-hmm.
So he could see through these bushes. The man couldn't see him. And he said, the man took out a screwdriver out of his pocket, and he was unscrewing the guest bedroom window. He said, by the time he got through the third screw, my father had came through those bushes. With that, he had a switchblade. He came through those bushes, and that man saw my father coming at him with their switchblade. He took off, and he ran. They ran two blocks. The one thing about my father is very, very athletic, because he would race all the kids on the block. He said, come on. You know how you play relay, but we would do that with the kids on the street.
Right.
My father would join us, and he said, I said, Daddy, you going around with us? He said, uh-huh. I'm going to give y'all a head start. Go ahead. He said, run. So all of us took off running. My father watched us. Then my father took off, passed all of us up. And he's at the end of the block. And he waiting for us to get there. He said, your father runs fast. I said, I know. So this man knew when my father was chasing him, you know, the guy was running for his life. Daddy came back. He hadn't caught him. He said, he ain't coming back in no more. And the man next door, older couple, they said, well, we know from now on, if there's any problems, we're coming to you, Mr. Lloyd. And they said, because we feel safe with you. We understood what that feeling was like, because we knew my father would take care of anybody.
Right.
And, you know, I write about how he had broke his foot walking our dog. Leona and I had to give up our dog, so we had apartments. So we gave to our father. You don't have a German Shepherd. I had a poodle. So he's walking the dog down the alley. He's the dog. The shepherd sees a cat. He takes off. My father gets dragged with the leash because his dog is charged at. So he breaks that cast down there. He has to have a cast on his leg. So we got him a lazy boy. And he wanted it out on the yard. He lived on a corner lot. And he's sitting there with the two dogs. One on each side, and that was what my father did. He didn't like, he never took a vacation. This was a forced vacation. And the kind of young guys came down the street, and they said, "Oh man, you better not be out here when we come by again." And they kept going. My father hobbled into the house, got his shotgun, came back out, sat down, put that thing across his lap. My mother said, "Oh," she called us. We come running over there. She said, "Your daddy gonna kill somebody. Your daddy gonna kill somebody." I said, "Well, Lord." And we went out there and talked to our father. He said, "Nobody tells me to go inside of my house. I live here." He said, "No one tells me." He said, "What I can and cannot do at my house." In other words, he wasn't going to live scared. He'd rather die than live scared.
Wow.
And he said, "No one tells me." And he sat out there with that gun till it got dark. He did this for a week. They didn't come back. If they did, they looked out there and saw that man sitting there with that shotgun. My father was like, "I'm not going to be told how to live in my own house."
Wow.
No. So, you know, these are lessons that we learn. When you stand up for something that you believe in, and you don't let fear take over, you know, and you in different positions, in different spectrums of your life, these are lessons we learned as young girls watching him. And, you know, my mother would cower. She's scared because she said, "Your daddy goes back." Daddy said, "I'm not going anywhere." You know, he had been through racism. He had been basically when he was in the service, and I talk about this, and he passed the exam to be an officer. But because of the racist situation back then, you could only eat with officers, but the officers were black and white. You can't eat with the white officers. There were no other black officers. So what are you going to eat by yourself?
Wow.
And then he, the sleeping quarters, same thing. He would have been isolated. And that would have been inhumane. And I talk about how that's used in a punishment way, even in today's penal system.
Right.
But, you know, I said, my father turned it down. He said he wanted to be with his men. And he couldn't be isolated by himself.
Right.
Now, that's racism dictating, you know, what you can and cannot do. Now, there may have been some men that decided to go along with that. But my father said, "No, I'm not. I want to be with my men." And I talk about how many men he was over when they went overseas and all this. My father was a very smart man. He's one of the smartest men I've ever known.
Right.
And you know, he loved reading. And you know, and we when he saw us reading the book on Malcolm X our first year in college, he said, "Why are you reading that?" And I said, "That's one of my books. Sociology, Daddy." I knew him. I said, "You knew this man? You knew this man?" He said, "They called me Troy Red." I said, and I always sat there listening, fascinated, listening to the story from my father, who rarely talked.
Right.
If he said something, you better listen, because it's going to be a gem.
Sure.
And when he did say something, you know, he just didn't waste words.
Let me ask you this question. And because there's, I mean, and certainly I know people are going to want to get this book, but what was the hardest chapter to write? The hardest chapter?
The one on my sister dying, that was the hardest one. That was the hardest one because I had to relive it.
Wow.
And it was, when I was writing, it was like 3 or 4 chapters in a row from us going to speak to these young kids, for their graduation, and then we had a choice between going to Michigan State's graduation that same day, or these eighth graders that were, you know, graduating and going into the ninth grade. And Yana said, let's do Hope Academy, because these kids, we can make a difference in their life. If they can see us, they can see it, they can be it. That is our thing, okay? And she said the ones in Michigan State, they're pretty much set. They're pretty much set. They can plan anything around their life. These kids have to understand they've got to get there. So I said, okay. And then Leona said, now we're going to dress in the robe. I said, Leona, it's like 85 degrees. It was a hot spell going for a long time. And she said, no. I said, but we're going to have on our suits on it. It's going to be hot. Because these were decorative robes with velvet on it. In court, we didn't have the velvet robes on. We used the lightweight robes because you don't want to sweat to death.
Right.
So, but for a ceremony, you put on the decorative robes, and those things weighed a ton, and they were heavy, and they were hot. And so she said, no, we're going to wear the ones with the velvet. I said, ah. And then she said, and we're going to wear a hat and the drape. And I said, Leona, that is too much. I said, she said, yeah, it makes a difference to these kids. I said, okay. And we got there, and we put all this stuff on. And when we walked out, we could hear that whole gymnasium full of all these people, right? Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh, the kids were just mesmerized. And the owner looked at me and she said, I told you. And I said, yeah, you're right. So, and, you know, and we got through speaking and, you know, they gave us a standing ovation and we stayed. We took pictures with all these kids because different parents would come up to us and say, will you take a picture? I said, no, I'm taking the robe off. Take a picture, okay? And so we said, okay. So we took them in our suits and we took pictures, as many as these parents wanted us. And they came up and said, I know you were trying to inspire our kids to go on, to prepare for the unknown, et cetera. They said, but you grabbed me. And I've been sitting around here, and it's time for me to start doing something with my life. She said, so you motivated me today. And I said, well, we get two for one. And it was good. And that's the thing. It's like this book is meant to motivate. It's meant to motivate. When I got a lot of responses to this book, and when one girl said, I feel I can take on the world. I got one from a third cousin who I've never met, who said, after reading your book, I'm going to go back, and I'm going back to school. So
that's awesome.
It motivates anybody to do something. Then the 3 years it took me to write this book, and it took 19 years for me to finally get to the point I could write the book, because I kept crying. I kept crying. Every time my secretary would remind me, she said, I know I heard you and your sister saying you were going to write a book. Both of you. She was always around us at the court. And she said, now she's gone, you're still going to write the book, right? I said, oh, I made that promise to her, and I'm still going to write this book. But every year at Christmas time, when we had off for 2 weeks, she said, Judge, you're going to start writing. I said, I don't know. First 5 years went by, I didn't do nothing. And the next 5 years, she's like clockwork. She never stopped asking. And I said, by the 10th year, I said, I've got a tape recorder. And I said, oh, you download these things now. Oh, my goodness. It's been a long time since I had a tape recorder. I had it in law school. I said, but now you download. And she laughed. She said, I'll type it, Judge. I'll type it. And I said, all I did was outline. And outline's very important for writers. But all I did was outline, because I kept crying. And I wouldn't gather pictures. That's thousands of pictures. I wouldn't gather pictures. And every time I looked at a picture, it reminded me of this. So it reminded me of that. And I would be crying. And so, again, you know, as much as you think you are, you're not through the grieving process, but you're working through it. You're working through it, and then all of a sudden, you take a turn and you're right back, you know, in that crying spell. So, because we were so close.
Can you talk about your grieving process? Because I mean, I know that. I mean, you and your sister were close. How did you get through that? I mean, I know it's probably in the book. I don't want you to give away too much, but just give our listeners a sense of how you mentioned 19 years and you'd start crying. How did you rise above that? How did you deal with your group? Finally, deal with it.
It, you know, well, when she passed, and you know, when you read it, you'll see how she passed, because I was the one trying to give her, you know, the CPR.
Right.
I'm trying to revive her, and we were laughing. We were watching a movie at her house. It was movie night. We called it movie night. Mm-hmm. We only had rented 3 DVDs, and she put it on, but her and my cousin, they were chattering, and I started it 3 times. I said, now, look, I ain't going to do it no more. Now, be quiet. And then Leona had come back from speaking, and she had walked 5 miles on the treadmill downstairs, so she had on her little exercise outfit.
Okay.
And she was very stylish. She liked to walk in style, so even if it was by herself. And so she got her little walking outfit on and said, okay, Leona, you're going to be quiet. And I'm sitting on the same couch with her. And when I started, the movie was called 60 Seconds. I'll never forget that. And when I started it, it had played maybe 5 minutes. And she kicked me. And she kicked me hard. And I said, what you kick me for? And her eyes were half masked. She was gone, just like that. And I didn't know. My cousin was calling EMS, and they were telling me what to do. And they're on their way. And the lady from now on, she's telling me, Gwen's holding the phone and all this, and I'm like, I can't believe this is happening. I cannot believe this is happening. We just spoke to all these kids. We came back. She called me 3 times at my house, and she said, Are you coming? I said, I'm on my way. I was just smacking on some ribs. So I said, I'm coming. And so God David said, well, I was going to come over. I said, no, I'm going to have movie night with my sister. Oh, well, you'd rather do that? I said, yeah, I would. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I'm heading down there, and I'm so glad I did.
Mm.
Okay, not knowing that would have been the last night. Okay, so, and she, we're all in a good mood, you know, we're laughing and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then she left, just like that. And so it is the hardest thing to understand. The closest thing was 9/11, when all those people went up in those buildings,
right,
and nobody saw them again.
Mm, wow.
And people said they had a feeling like no closure. Like, where did they go? Well, I felt, I wondered where she went, because she was right here. She was right here talking to me.
Right.
You know, and Leona was talking to Gwen. And so, you know, I get an ambulance. They got this machine on her and all of this. And it's going back. It's pumping and pumping. I said, is she going to be all right? The lady looked at me and didn't say a word. And then when they pull her in there, and then they had me sit outside the room, and I'm watching, I'm pacing the floor. And it was in writing that that my girlfriend had told me. She said, you got to take us there, Leon. She said, you got to take us there. And I said, okay, well, when I finish, I'm going to do these 3 or 4 chapters, and I'm going to send it to you, then you tell me if I took you there. And it was hard writing it, because I had to relive it. I had to relive all that.
Right.
And she said, no, it's nice, but it's not, I'm not there. So I sent another draft. And she said, this is better, but I'm not there. And then I rolled my sleeves up, and I got to thinking, and I started, I'm on the computer, and I'm just going, and I'm crying, and I'm crying, and I'm crying, and I couldn't stop crying, but I couldn't stop typing. I couldn't stop. And when I sent it to her, I said, well, I don't know what she's going to think about this, but I'm wiped out. I'm so wiped out right now.
Right.
And so she, at about a half hour later, she said, you took me there, and I haven't stopped crying since I read this.
Wow. I do thank you for just sharing so much of yourself with the audience. It's time for us to wrap it up, and I wanted to give you the opportunity to share some final thoughts, and if you want to tell people how they can get your book, and anything else you want to share, feel free to do so at this time.
Okay, well, they can definitely get the book on Amazon.com.
Okay.
There's a link, but if you don't have the link, then you go to Judge Leona Millett's book, and you'll get it like that. And then there's also my website. You can go; it has all the information on it too about that. And my website is judgeleonaloyd.com. That's kind of easy. So that has all the information on it, including the trailer and everything. So it has everything on it for people to make that contact. The last thought that I just want for the listeners is that I'm trying to say in this book, by telling you about our lives, the ups and the downs and the struggles that we went through, you got to believe in yourself. You got to believe in yourself, no matter how many doors close, no matter how many times you fall, you just got to keep getting back up. And you can't take no for an answer. You have to have a plan. You have to know where you want to go. And keep working that plan. And don't let anybody stop you. Don't let anybody stop you. Because it's not if you reach that goal, but when you reach that goal. And that's what I want them to understand, that no matter what, they can do whatever they put their minds to, period. I've seen it happen too many times. I had so many miracles happen in the 15 years I did drug court in my courtroom. I saw God working in my courtroom. Wow. I saw God working. I saw him change people. And, I can't tell you how many times tears were down my face watching people, just watching people change in front of me.
Wow.
And people that no one ever thought would ever change, ever, you know, and right. Because they had done too many things, too many people had given up on them. And I saw what happened. And if you mixed any type of faith sessions with this, if they went to churches, if they went to faith-based treatments or something like that, it stuck even more so.
Wow.
It stuck even more so. And to this day, when I got on Facebook, a lot of the people that graduated drug court, I had over 1,000 people graduate, they would contact me right and left. Judge Lord, we never thought we'd see you again. And I got a chance to see and hear from them and see that they're still doing well, that they didn't stop. You know, ladies who were on the streets for 15 years as prostitutes, and that's a lifestyle to be addicted to as well as a drug, okay, and for them to make turnaround, become nurses, become counselors themselves, master's degrees, all of it, okay? You don't tell me it ain't impossible. With God, anything is possible.
Amen.
With anything is possible.
Amen to that.
Anything, you know, and I've seen it time and time again. They used to say, thank you, Judge Lord, for helping. I said, well, first of all, I didn't do it. I said, God did it, and you did it. I'm his instrument. I'm just helping guide you, support you, giving you the strength that you need. Yeah, I said, when I think you're going to fall down, but I'm not the one who did it. I said, you did. And
wow.
So did he. I said, you're on his path. Stay on that path of excellence. This is the one he wants you on. This is not the one you decided to take. This is the one he wants you on. So all my listeners have to find that path. What is it that you gave up on? You thought it was too late. You thought, I had people 50 years old become licensed truck drivers, complete academy. One woman said, Judge, you said it ain't too late, it ain't. I'm going to be driving my first big rig. And she was telling me where she was going to be going. She had her certification, the whole hit. You can't tell me. I've seen too many people do too many things. And these are people who have all the odds against them. One
sure.
girl said she was uneducable. She couldn't even be taught. We're going to pay you money to live because you're not trainable.
Wow.
And she said, Judge Lord, can I just take the GED program with the rest of them that you have them going? I said, sure you can. I don't believe in labels. And so when she graduated drug court, she had went up several grade levels in the GED process, but she hadn't passed anything. And I said, this is what I want you to do. I said, I believe you're going to pass. I'm going to keep doing it, Judge, until I pass. I said, okay. And when you do, you bring me back a copy of that. Because she saw me copy everybody's, and I kept copying. I had drawers and drawers filled with all kinds of certificates, diplomas. You name it, I had it from what they were doing. And she said, I want to bring mine back, too. I said, you can. Do you know, about 4 years later, she walked in, and she'd had a baby. And I said, I looked at her, I smiled, I called her name, and I said, would you come see me today? Well, she said, to let you see this and let you make a copy of it for your records. And so she had passed the GED. 2 years later, she got an associate's degree. in counseling. And she came back, and she was watching me in court. She was chiming in on some of the cases I had, explaining to them what they had to do in counseling to make sure that they didn't go back to the streets. This little girl was told she wasn't ever going to be nothing, ever, ever. Now, think about that. You're living with a label, but you've got someone pushing you saying, yes, you can. Yes, you can. That's all they needed. Someone in authority who said, I know you can do it. I know you can do it.
Wow.
And they would tell me, because you thought I could do it, that made me believe I could do it. But I really believe they could. They just had to readjust their plans. I'm telling my readers, readjust your plans. Make a plan. Set goals. Work the plan. And no matter what, you keep sticking to the plan until you reach your goal.
Wow.
That's what I want them to do.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you've enjoyed this presentation. I know I have. I'm going to post her information on my Facebook page, my business page, so that you will be able, as well as Instagram, you'll be able to find this wonderful book, Your Honor, by Leandra Lloyd. Thank you so much for being with us, and have a great day.
Okay, you too, and thank you for having me.
Oh,
thank you so much.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Bethlehem House is a respite for homeless working women. They can stay here for up to a year. When they come, they're kind of disheveled a little bit, but we try and put them back together here. Our goal is for them to save money. It's very important. And clean their credit. Because without good credit, your money is no good. Isn't that amazing? But they stay here for a year, and we kind of get them back together, and they go on.
So, Sam, I heard your grandma say they're donating that car to Charity Motors.
Yeah.
Said they're getting a full fair market tax deduction for it.
I do not know what that means.
It means we get whatever it's worth as a tax deduction right when we donate it.
Nope, not getting it.
It means we get money for it. So does the charity we pick. And the car goes half off to someone who really needs it.
Dollar bills, Sam. Whoop, whoop. Charity Motors.
Yep.
No working woman should be homeless. Find out how you can help at BethlehemHouse.org. And remember, the year's drawing to a close quickly. Isn't that something? The last few months of the year, and we're already here. Well, I'm sure some of you are glad to see 2020 on its way. But there is a benefit to be had by you by donating your car to Charity Motors. And even if you don't have a car, you can make a donation, because guess what? The needs never stop. Find out more about Charity Motors at charitymotors.org. Charitymotors.org.
Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to leave it right there. Thank you for tuning in to The Spectrum with Bob Ivory. Well, hit me up on Instagram at Bobby Ray Ivory Jr. on Instagram, or Bobby Ray Ivory Jr. on Facebook. Hope you're having a fantastic day. And listen, I want you to go out there and have a fantastic day on purpose. And you know, I mean that.
One hundred percent.
100% black owned and operated.
They said it couldn't be done.
We did it anyway.
The hottest independent network in the world.
Kaboom!
You want prizes? We've got free prizes. You want cash? We've got lots of cash. Simply download Bashani Radio app. Allow push notifications and listen for your chance to win loads of cash. Please don't tell our CEO it's his money we're giving away. We won't tell if you won't tell. Bashani Radio app. Download it for free in the App Store.